It's UN Day today, and we have two guests that will explain what the UN's decision means for Hamilton.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
In studio, we have Jeff Wingert from the Hamilton SPRC and Craig Foy from the McQuesten Legal Clinic. Craig just got back from Geneva, and if we could just take a minute, Craig, if you wouldn't mind. I know there's a lot of presenters in Geneva from Canada, and I wondered if you met them and if you got to hear what they had to say, and just fill us in on what it was like.
Well, it was really busy, first off. There was probably close to around 20 non-governmental organizations represented at the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights 36th session in Geneva, ranging from very grassroots type groups, such as Josephine Gray, who was representing low-income families together, up to larger kind of institutional NGOs, such as Amnesty International Canada, which was represented by Alain Waugh. There was constitutional law experts from Canada, such as Bruce Porter and Sheila Day and Gwen Brodsky, representatives from the National Anti-Poverty Organization. There was a representative there from the Six Nations, Doreen Silversmith, who luckily had been attending on behalf of a women's group named Forward from Toronto already, so it really worked well for her to also be able to be there and present with regard to Six Nations issues. And it was an amazing professional experience, but ultimately what we're looking for is to be able to affect some change through going on that trip. I mean, ultimately, if we don't affect some change with regard to the right to an adequate standard of living and it being realized in Hamilton, then it will have been somewhat of a waste. So we're working on that now.
Key is to make people more aware of what was said and to push the initiative that was started there. You said there was about 20 different people or groups representing Canada?
It's interesting you say representing Canada. I would actually agree that they were there representing Canada. They were there representing non-governmental organizations from Canada. But there was also a delegation, of course, from the government of Canada who were giving Canada's report, both their fourth and their fifth reports to the committee. Canada is supposed to go in front of this committee every 4 years. The last time they went was back in 98, so it's been 8 years since they were there. So they were actually presenting two reports at once, which the committee commented on at the very outset of the session, indicating that that really didn't help facilitate things for them.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying the government of Canada rather than provincial representatives from each province. What was the gist of their presentation?
Well, I should mention that there actually were some provincial representatives there. I know there was a provincial representative from Ontario. There was a provincial representative from Newfoundland.
Were they speaking the same language is the first thing that comes to my mind between the reps for the country and the reps for the province?
Yeah, I think the report from Canada actually contained reports, contained within it reports from the provinces. So I think very much the government representatives, I think probably you could say were speaking from the same page. Unfortunately, in my opinion, that page they were speaking from was extremely misleading with regard to the covenant rights and whether they're being protected in Canada. Essentially, I don't think it would be inaccurate to say that the government representatives were standing up in front of the committee saying that they thought that the government of Canada was doing very well with regard to protecting covenant rights since their last report. Unfortunately, obviously, you've read our report, the right to an adequate standard of living in Hamilton. We don't believe that that right's even being acknowledged, let alone protected, certainly in Hamilton and, again, across Canada. And that was what we said to the committee. We really endeavored to provide them with as much factual evidence and statistical data to be able to be informed and to ask intelligent questions of the government of Canada. And I think now that we have the report from the United Nations Committee, I think we're seeing that that in fact we had some effect in that regard.
Yeah, I just glanced over the report. It pretty much pinpointed Hamilton as one of the centers. But before we get too far into how it affects our local community, I wanted to get back to the point that here we have all these, you call them non-government groups presenting, all these poverty groups. Mm-hmm. Quite a few of them are from Ontario and yourself as well. And then in our studio, we also have Jeff Wingard from the SPRC, who has worked with poverty on the streets in Hamilton for how many years has it been, Jeff, now?
It's coming up on 7 years, believe it or not.
Yeah. And how much change have you seen in those 7 years?
Well, I don't think we've seen the kind of change that we were hoping for. I think in a lot of ways, we've seen homelessness increase over that time. Recently, that's finally kind of plateaued off, but we're still at double where we were 10 years ago in terms of the number of people that are in shelters in Hamilton. So I think there have been very minor improvements in some corners, but really, if you're talking about social assistance rates, if you're talking about homelessness, kind of the deepest poor in our community, things are definitely worse than they have been for quite some time.
Okay, so let's go back to the United Nations, and we've seen on our streets what it's been like in the last 8 years. We just discovered that Canada hasn't been to the UN in 8 years, and we have all these presentations. Now, let's explain what this Economic and Social Council is to the listeners and what it does in the United Nations and what these agreements are, and sort of clear up that kind of situation so that people that don't know anything about this council, we'll ask Craig actually here to explain maybe from the legal perspective what the agreement means, what it is, and why it is in the UN.
The Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights is a committee body under the UN High Commission for Human Rights, which you may know is a Canadian former Supreme Court Justice, Louise Arbour, is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights now. Specifically, the Committee for Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights is tasked with receiving reports from countries that are signatory nations to a document called the International Covenant for Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. That document is ratified by a number of countries, Canada being one of them. Canada ratified that document, I believe, in 1977. So this isn't really a relatively recent thing. It's actually older. It's an older right than the rights in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Countries, as I said earlier, give periodic reports to the committee. The committee then releases concluding observations with regard to that country's compliance or noncompliance with regard to the international covenant rights. The committee also releases general comments from time to time in order to expound on the rights found in the covenant and to give further direction to countries in protecting those rights. There's other committees under the UN High Commission for Human Rights, such as the Committee Against Torture, which actually was meeting at the very same time we were there. I think they were probably getting most of the press because, interestingly, the United States was going in front of the Committee Against Torture at the very same time we were there, and so a report's been released with regard to that. There's also the Committee for Civil and Political Rights, which is really kind of a sister document under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a sister document to the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So the Committee on Civil and Political Rights actually met last year to look at Canada. So there's a number of different bodies made up of experts from around the world who do this work on a part-time basis, as I understand. Yeah.
And the reason for this whole committee is? Explain signatory for one.
Signatory means that Canada has signed and ratified. You get used to using some of this language all the
ratified
time.
What does it mean in plain language?
Yeah, it means that the government of Canada has said that they are going to adhere to this document. Adhere meaning that they're going to protect the rights that are enunciated, that are set down in the International Covenant for Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So, for instance, the right to an adequate standard of living for everyone in our city, with the right, including food, housing, clothing, and the continuous improvement of that standard of living is something that Canada has promised.
Okay. Okay. So, what are the advantages to or for a country to sign these papers, these commitments? What's the advantage for countries?
Well, I think that I think that it's an ethical statement by a country, for one. I think that's a huge part of it. I think that a big part of rights in general is a moral statement. So, if, for instance, domestically, our Charter of Rights and Freedoms contains a number of rights in there that we consider ethical necessities in our country. But I think that further than that, you can argue that these rights, I think, are part of actually being a successful country with successful communities where people want to live. And I certainly believe that. That's the kind of community that I want to bring my family up in.
Okay, so we know, in CFMU here in this little booth, the three of us, we know that Canada's been failing terribly for 10 or more years. So obviously, it doesn't seem to mean much to sign this paper, this agreement, in front of the world, in front of the UN different committees. It doesn't seem to have made a difference. Why is that?
Well, I think it would be a good idea if you could, Maggie, to actually get some government representatives in here to answer that. I'm certainly not going to put words into their mouth. I think what you say is accurate, and this is certainly the sense you got from the committee. I think when you read their document now, the concluding observations on Canada, and actually being in the room when they began questioning Canada with regard to their report, you got the sense, I think, from the committee that they were very frustrated that Canada seemed to be ignoring the issues of concern and recommendations that were made in 1993 and 1998.
I agree with you. Maybe it's a topic for another show. I have my own theories. You were telling us that you were watching the response from the UN, the committee members, to these various reports. What did it make you feel? How did you feel watching this?
Well, I mean, personally, I definitely felt a sense of relief, you know, as somebody who works in this community, whose agency, McQuesten Legal and Community Services, our board really put enormous trust in me by sending me, you know, spending really thousands of dollars to send me to Geneva, a very expensive city, to do this. We spent a week, all of the NGOs that were there spent really a lot of time putting together statistical evidence and data for the committee members, trying to make sure that we got information to them. And then on Friday morning, Canada, the Canadian delegation, went in front of the committee. And of course, you're kind of sitting there waiting with bated breath. Well, what are the committee's questions going to sound like? And it became clear from Mr. Pillay, who was the first one to ask the question, the representative from Mauritius on the committee. His question was a very long question and basically said a lot of what you've said right now, Megan, and what a lot of people are saying, which is that, look, the committee has made all of these recommendations, very clear recommendations to Canada, and you haven't followed up on them. In fact, you've ignored some of them, it appears, and in fact, there may be you may have taken retrogressive measures with regard to some other issues of concern to the committee. And in fact, he made specific mention of the National Child Benefit Supplement as being something that was a very clear recommendation from the committee, something that could fairly simply be implemented and yet had not been implemented by the Canadian government. That really started to set the tone, I think, for the questions from the committee. So You're thankful at that point as somebody who's there, who's spending, you know, your agency's money to be there. But as I said earlier, I think the work now is to make this all worth it, is to put pressure on senior levels of government now that we have this report to actually follow the recommendations made by the committee. And I think that would be of enormous benefit to our community here in Hamilton.
Well, we're going to get to the local part of the situation here. I have a copy of the report, thanks to yourself, and I'll be reading some of those highlighted areas. But it's exactly all the areas that all the poverty groups in Hamilton have been screaming about for the last 8 years, if not longer. And, you know, I'm going to go to Mr. Wingard here and ask him, I mean, the National Child Benefit. This is your baby. This is something that you've been really in City Hall, in front of City Hall. Every time I go for a social committee member meeting in council, there's Jeff Wingard talking about the NCB and giving all kinds of solutions locally. But really, you know, there's only so much that we can do locally. So,
well, one of the things I think that is really a lost opportunity is that the clawback of the National Child Benefit is really unfortunate. It's something that governments refuse to take real action on, provincial and federal governments anyway. And it really hits the poorest families the hardest. And it's really, I think, ironic that we say that we want to really address child poverty in Hamilton. And yet here we have a policy that is clearly making it worse, and we don't do anything about it. You know, one of the things that when I looked at the report that Craig brought back from Geneva, or that they published based on that, one of the things that they said was that Canada's way ahead of a lot of other countries in terms of its ability to implement these changes, that we're one of the only countries with a surplus year after year. We're one of the only countries with a lot of the institutions in place to make the kind of changes that the committee is asking for. So I think when you were asking about why aren't we implementing these, I think that's the central question. I think obviously there are some enforcement issues with the UN that they're not really set up to do that kind of thing. But I think when we're asking what kind of country we want to live in, what kind of community we want to live in, Canada has ranked consistently high on international measures of like the Human Development Index. I mean, this is something that we value as Canadians. And yet here we have problems pointed out by the UN and others that it is within our grasp to make these changes. When you look at the last federal budget, I think, you know, we got kind of an indication that actually the government is not only not implementing these, but they were actually walking away from a lot of these changes. So we saw tax cuts. We didn't see increased investment. And I think that's one of the things that we were hoping for. It was we could have easily increased funding to the poorest families, ended the National Child Benefit, increased transfers to the province to do the kind of things like raise social assistance rates and all that. And we didn't do it. And that was, I think, really disappointing for people that have worked on these issues for a long time.
And we've been working on them from a provincial point of view and a federal point of view. And, you know, all that hard work we did with the Liberals on a federal level and the plans that the city made, you know, all that's just been changed in the blink of an eye as soon as Harper gets in. Maybe you can explain to some of the people who haven't been following these issues this closely what it really means to lose the NCB and to lose a daycare and things like that.
Well, there were a couple of initiatives. I think, you know, I actually moved to Canada right when the Liberals first took power. So I've only been in Canada under Liberal government. So when the change of government happened, it was quite a shock in a lot of ways. Like all of a sudden, programs that you kind of assumed would just go and go and go, their future was in question. And in the case of the daycare arrangement, like it was just off the table, or at least seems to be off the table. Now, the National Child Benefit clawback, that's a provincial decision that really is within the province's ability to change. And the provincial Liberals have said we will change it. And they have been remarkably slow to move on that. And they are really struggling with how best to do that. There were a couple of programs, actually, that I think were pretty effective at dealing with homelessness, namely the Skippy program. That brought quite a bit of money into the community that Craig actually has worked on a few years ago as well. And then the federal provincial housing, affordable housing agreement. Both of those policies were products of the federal government and meant quite a few resources that I think made a contribution to addressing homelessness. Both of those, I think, are in jeopardy currently in terms of whether or not they'll be continued. There's certainly speculation that they won't be. And if they won't be, we're going to be really hard hit. Because I think at the bottom line of a lot of this stuff, the concerns that we have around poverty, the concerns we have around affordable housing and homelessness, we need to think in terms of investing more resources into that rather than cutting taxes and investing less. And certainly what we've seen out of the federal government currently is that we haven't seen the increase in spending that really is necessary for cities and for people that are living below the poverty line to get above.
Yeah, and all that work that the cities were doing with the federal government before to get a voice after amalgamation. And I mean, it's like all that work just disappeared. But on a personal level, I mean, Hamilton's being held up as one of the, if not the center in Ontario for poverty. 20%, sometimes the numbers are a little higher. For the UN to even isolate cities like Montreal and Hamilton, it's just, you know, how many years do we have to go on saying that Hamilton is the worst hit for poverty and having our city hall councilors jump through hoops and find all kinds of ways to find money when we're one of maybe the only province or only situation that has social costs and housing costs and welfare come off the personal taxpayer, the property tax. It's just a ludicrous idea that the Tories brought in, and we've been triply suffering ever since.
Well, certainly, Ontario has redistributed the way we pay for social assistance and social housing, and it's taken it off the progressive income tax base that it should be on. And certainly, we've asked, and lots of people, including the city, have said we need to rethink the way we fund those programs. My understanding is there's broad political support across the three parties for making that kind of change, but how and when that gets done is an entirely different question.
Is this going to change the way you've been sort of promoting and trying to get money for Skippy and that, these funds that, I mean, there's been so many years of hard work and discussion and familiarity coming with the Liberal federal government. I sat and watched Joanne Brel and our social committees making plans on the city based on what they thought they had done, all this work they had done with the federal government. So how is it going to change all the work you've done? How is it going to change our situation here?
Well, I guess I'd have a couple of responses to that. I think, you know, certainly the city of Hamilton is put in a difficult position of delivering federal programs and federal money all the time, and they have to make adjustments based on that. While the Liberal government, the federal government has done a lot of good in the last 10 years, I mean, the thing is that we're still left. We saw huge rises in homelessness over that time. The dismantling of several policies, in particular, there was one in 1995 when the Canada Assistance Plan was dismantled and split into two. The Canada Health and Social became the Canada Health Transfer and the Canada Social Transfer. It really changed the social policy dynamics in Canada. It really made it a very different place where provinces had the freedom to do a lot more around income assistance. That's when you saw the Harris government come in and make some substantial cuts to welfare. And the federal government really freed that up. So I don't think that the change in government is going to really – I mean, there are certain programs that are in jeopardy for sure, but I think we need to continue to work with what's happening at the federal level. I don't think we know what's going to happen. I think the city will be in a difficult place to certainly around the daycare funding that they were hoping to get. That will impact a lot of folks negatively.
Since Jeff has mentioned the Canada Assistance Plan, I think I'd really like to mention the fact that, and I know the UN committee has remarked on this, the fact that we're not setting national standards in Canada. Canada has signed on to this international document. All of the provinces okayed that before Canada signed on, so all the provinces have signed on too. And with the removal of the Canada Assistance Plan, we removed any national standards with regard to social assistance, with regard to social programs in general. And so, right now, we have really the absurd situation of having social assistance programs, for instance, in our community, under which the rates are completely arbitrary. There's absolutely no relation or analysis to the actual cost of basic needs in our community. And so, as someone who actually works in a community legal clinic where we're often seeing people who are on social assistance, what we see, instead of seeing people who enter into a program that's going to help them, as one of the stated objectives of the program is going to help them get back into the workforce, rather what we see is the families most often going on to this program and then spiraling deeper and deeper into poverty for every month that they're actually on the program, because every month there's a shortfall because the program is paying them below subsistence level income. And so every month there's that shortfall. And so the longer they're actually on the system, the farther they are away from getting back into a kind of productive situation.
No chance to improve. When you're sliding down that you're not even surviving anymore.
Yeah. And so it's just what we need, really. I mean, I think if we sat down right now, Jeff and I and you, Maggie, with all of our local politicians and discussed that with them, I think you would find across the board, on a nonpartisan basis, they would all say that's ludicrous. We need to have a system that is actually related to the cost of basic needs, and we have to set standards in this country, not only for social assistance, But with regard to a poverty level, Canada refuses to say what their official poverty line is. We need to set some standards in this country, and then I think that that's one of the first steps to starting to adhere to our obligations under the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights.
Well, let's talk about how the UN views standards. What is their level of, you know, define the definition that they use for a standard of living?
In the actual document, in the actual covenant, they refer to food, clothing, housing. Social security is also referred to in there. So these are the kind of things that that you know for sure are part of an adequate standard of living. I think, in my opinion, I think the first step that we need to take in Canada and in Ontario in particular, because we're in Ontario right now, is we have to start that discussion to ask what is an adequate standard of living. Even though we haven't had that discussion yet, I don't think that I don't think you could find someone, anyone, the biggest libertarian, right-wing libertarian you can find in Hamilton, I don't think that they could say with a straight face that social assistance rates, as they stand right now, are an adequate standard of living. By any analysis, the most conservative analysis, they fall far below subsistence
levels. They even admit to it in legislature. I mean, Pubatello, when she was a minister, even before she was the minister, she's running around saying it's so substandard. You know, everybody knows this politically. They seem to know that they're not paying people enough to get by, but nobody's doing anything about it, except for the people like yourselves, you know, slugging away in grassroots groups.
Well, so further to, I think, this discussion, there's a guy named Chris Sarlo who does research for the Fraser Institute. He's kind of infamous in a lot of anti-poverty group circles. He is one of the researchers who, in terms of poverty, is probably the most restrictive guy researcher that we've seen. He draws his he says we are going to talk about poverty as not able to get enough to eat and not able to secure housing on a regular basis. So he looked at the last 40 years, and what he found was that things dropped, actually, from 1942 to 1992. So the number of people that were actually unable to get food and unable to find housing has gotten better over the last 40 years. But starting in 1992, it was interesting. It totally plateaued and even rose a little bit. So this is like the deepest measure of poverty in our community. And it's gotten even worse over the last 10 to 15 years. And I think you've seen this. The other interesting thing is that social assistance rates for a long time were above his line of and it's a really restrictive definition, way to measure poverty. And now, 10 years later, it's at about 60%. So 60% of his line, which means that the people on social assistance, by even the most restrictive researchers, are way below what is required to get enough food and enough housing. And this is just, this is the, like Craig is saying, the most right-wing libertarian. This research would probably fall into that category. And I would agree that there is an absolute consensus across the board that social assistance rates simply do not pay enough to live. And in many cases, makes it worse for families because they spend a lot of their time trying to figure out how to survive and don't have time to figure out how to get back into the workforce.
Even minimum wage people, they're working full-time hours and minimum wage is woefully inadequate. It should be around $12.50 at least. And would we just get $8? We just struggle to get $8.
I think it becomes $8 in
NMA or something like that. So, we know this. This has been discussed. There's got to be some way to make the connection. And I've heard some poverty activists say it's political will. It's public will. So the politicians aren't moving because the public isn't pressuring them enough, is the theory. Other than that, what suggestions do you gentlemen have?
It's funny, we have these kind of discussions quite often in doing the kind of work that we do. I know you probably have them at the Social Planning and Research Council on
a regular
basis. Jeff, about what can you do and what kind of situation do you need to create in order for change to happen? I think there's a side of me that thinks that you have to create a situation that actually forces forces all the politicians to forces their hand and forces them to change things. I don't know if that's really being to be honest, I don't know that that's really being fair to the politicians. I think if you create an environment where they feel like they can make the change, I think that perhaps then that will happen. Perhaps I'm being overly optimistic now, but I think that now that we have this situation in Hamilton where we've got this report from the UN, we've created this community dialogue on this report. Our local newspaper has really gone above board to cover poverty as the primary issue in our community. We have business leaders and nonprofit leaders and government leaders sitting down at a round table to actually look at poverty issues. Perhaps now is the time where politicians, where our elected representatives feel comfortable to make these changes and see that it's not going to be a costly change for them. I really hope that we could have a nonpartisan kind of Hamilton caucus on these issues in order to make these changes.
I'm going to ask you to define how you mean the politicians feel comfortable. I'm curious now, how do you mean that? Because are you suggesting that we let them save face, or are you suggesting it's because they think the business community won't rear up and say, no, more tax cuts are needed? I mean, that's the cry they always complain about.
Well, I don't think I'm saying anything surprising to say it's not a, I don't know the word sexy. It's not a sexy political issue. It's not an issue that politicians generally bring up. Even our left wing parties in Canada.
But it's a moral issue. The UN says it's a moral issue.
Absolutely,
Canada
Absolutely.
Is a moral country, or it used to be a moral country.
Yeah.
So let's get to the gist of where is the emotional or egotistical or financial problem.
I think in Hamilton here. I mean, I think right now we have some politicians who are outspoken on these issues. So I shouldn't say that I don't that party people aren't talking about this. I know our local federal politicians in the old city of Hamilton, David Christopherson, Wayne Marsden, politicians in this community who are also
Judy Marcells. Let's talk about that. Why isn't she there?
Well, I suspect I don't know that she was invited. That's a And I think sometimes it's a little bit unfair. I think sometimes we haven't invited certain people to the table, and I think that's part of what I'm saying is that if we create a situation, and by you asked what do I mean by creating a situation where politicians are comfortable in making the changes, and what I mean by that is we've created a situation where there's already a community dialogue on these issues. So this issue is already out in the forefront in the community. The community is aware of the issue. They are aware of the need, and they expect politicians to do something about it. So you're not so much forcing their hand as creating an environment where they're comfortable making an ethical decision that they know is the right
ethical
decision.
Okay, so Hamilton is making history in that respect. And I know there's been some complaints about who sits at the round table and what's said at the round table. But it is making history in some regards.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's happened with the development of the Roundtable for Poverty, alleviation, I think it is now, is that the broad community has come together and said, we need to address poverty. As a community, we need to do that. I think one of the difficulties addressing poverty is it's a hard social issue. It's not one cause that you can kind of say, we're going to address this particular issue and then it's going to be gone. I mean, when you look at who is poor in Hamilton, recent immigrants, one in two, every other recent immigrant lives below the poverty line. Aboriginal people, visible minorities, seniors, single, like lone parent families, they're all poor for very different reasons. So when we talk about needing to address poverty, it's there's a multitude of responses. And the other tricky thing, I think, with governments in particular, is that with the local government, the provincial government, and the federal government, it gets complicated in a hurry in terms of who's responsible for what. I know one of the things that we've heard from the provincial government, particularly around the clawback, ending the clawback, is that they inherited a deficit. So
Do we believe them?
Well, I mean, regardless of whether or not we believe them or not, I think there are certain financial pressures. They certainly don't appear to have a surplus like the federal government. I remember back to one of the initial consultations around homelessness in Toronto about, I guess, 8 years ago now. And they, one of the big findings of that was the Golden Report. And they said, you know what Canadians want? They want the intergovernmental squabbling to stop and for action to be taken on homelessness. And I guess part of the frustration in working on these issues for a while is that, you know, well, the provincial government's not really in a position to move quickly on this. The federal government's not really willing to. The local government wants to, but doesn't really have the tools at its disposal to do it. So it gets very tricky very quickly. That's one of the reasons that poverty, I think, is difficult, and that it's difficult to get kind of leadership by all the different levels of government to take action.
Okay, so our local politicians, let's just pretend we're excluding them for the most part in this conversation today, because if people are interested, they can always watch what's going on with our City Hall on Cable 14. So, you know, they will see City Hall discussing this on a regular basis. So we're not really referring to the City of Hamilton's politicians so much when we're talking about government right now. We're talking about the federal government. We're talking about the provincial government. We're talking about the problem that two of them can't seem to agree, and yet they're both at the UN. Well, to an extent, they're both at the UN. I find that kind of ironic that we've got how many provinces were at the UN, Craig?
I can't remember exactly, Maggie. I think
three?
It was about three, maybe four.
And it's Newfoundland, which is notoriously poor, and Ontario, which is overridden with poverty. What was the third one?
I should mention that Newfoundland is the only province in Canada, I believe, now that has actually indexed their social assistance rates.
That's amazing.
So I don't know a lot about the adequacy of their rates, but at least they've taken the important step of indexing them to the cost of living and inflation.
And I think earlier Craig was talking about national standards, and I think that's one of the reasons that the different levels of government, especially in the past few years, like there's no requirement that provinces are on the same page with regard to social assistance. And I think leadership at the national level would be really helpful, and it would allow us as a community to have some discussion and dialogue about where that level should be. I mean, certainly the amount of money that people get for housing is not even close to what it costs to rent an apartment in Hamilton.
Well, it varies from province to province, so that's one of the problems that makes that difficult. But, you know, I remember hearing discussions saying, you know, it should be the federal government that takes care of welfare, social assistance payments, and it should be that government that monitors, and each province. But, you know, the provinces are allotted a percentile that they can't seem to work with the federal government now. Maybe we can explain some of that to people who aren't on social assistance and therefore don't know what we're talking about here.
You're asking about the transfer payments, the social transfer
payments? Yeah, how it's set up now. And I mean, the province says that they're hamstrung because it's an 80-20 thing with the city and the province, and the province and the federal government have different arrangements, you know?
Yeah, I mean, again, this goes to how complex some of the stuff, some of these issues get. I mean, the city is responsible for administering a certain portion of this, and some of it comes from the provincial government, some of it comes from the local government, even the clawback, some money that's clawed back from the poorest families, the city gets to keep some of that, most of it goes back to the province. So I think, I mean, really, for the listeners, I think one of the messages that has to be communicated to decision makers is that what's happening is unacceptable, and that they need to find a way to address it. And I think it's really difficult to understand all the nuances of it. It's really hard. But I think the message is it's unacceptable. We need to find a way to fix it. We need to have a social assistance system that helps people, pays enough to help people meet their basic needs, in addition to to start to get at some of the reasons that people are experiencing poverty.
I'm not an expert. I should preface any comments on the issue of transfer payments between the government and the provinces. There were other NGOs there that were presenting on that, Maggie. But I should note that in the concluding observations of the committee in paragraph 20, they actually comment with concern with regard to the fact that the Canada social transfer has not even been restored to 1994-95 levels in spite of the sustained economic growth in the state party during these last 10 years. So so the committee was very concerned that, in fact, we've actually cut social transfer payments during that period of time. If I could just really quickly engage something that you said earlier, Maggie, because it just kind of it sat with me after you mentioned it. You mentioned something about the business community being up in arms if we raise social assistance. I think that's a misapprehension that a lot of people have, is that that social assistance payments and increasing social assistance payments is going to be bad for business, and I think quite the contrary would be true. What you see is that those social assistance payments, the increase, every single dollar of that increase, I would wager, is going to be spent locally in our community on local businesses. So people are being paid below subsistence levels now. So if you actually raise to subsistence levels, that means that every dollar that's being spent by people is actually being spent on subsistence goods. Subsistence goods are bought locally. And so what you'll have is a huge money multiplier under economic theory, where all of that money is being spent locally and is actually going to be fantastic for local businesses. I wish somebody would actually do the research on the financial impact in Hamilton when social assistance rates were cut in 1995, because I think it would be very stark to see what that did to our business community in Hamilton.
You were talking earlier, Craig, about the UN. In fact, we were discussing, you know, what is their role? And sounds like we need an enforcer. So I always thought the UN was the enforcer, just by pointing out our moral position in the world. Is there some way that the UN can stand upon their statement that they just made, that is actually kind of embarrassing for our country to be discussed in such a manner?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Maggie, that one of the things that that the UN brings to the table, of course, is bringing these issues to light and kind of I would say right now it's a bit of an international disgrace with regard to Canada on this issue, and I think that brings some moral force to bear on our government. With regard to actual legal enforcement, there's two sides to that question. There's domestic enforcement. Unfortunately, we have not brought economic, social, and cultural rights, or the majority of those rights, into our domestic instruments, such as provincial human rights codes or our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. In fact, quite the opposite, and the committee commented on this, we have at times our provincial attorneys general arguing against an interpretation of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms that would take into account covenant rights. So often you have the governments working against that. On the international, the other side would be the international enforcement side, and there have been preliminary discussions now with regard to an optional protocol to the economic covenant, or to the covenant, international covenant on economic, social, and cultural rights. This optional protocol would contain some enforcement mechanisms with regard to those rights. Still at very preliminary stages. If people want to read about it, you could search, I guess, on the web. With, you know what, you can go to my blog. It's so funny to say that. You can go to the blog. The link is on hamiltonlegalclinics.ca, and you can go to the blog, and you'll probably see the second entry down. I've got discussion of the optional protocol, and I've got a link to an article by Bruce Porter. Unfortunately, I don't want to go on and on about this, but unfortunately, Canada has not been supportive of this optional protocol. I think they're putting forth a position where it would only concern certain rights under the covenant and wouldn't consider all of the rights. So, and they wouldn't give us a definitive answer when we met with them in Geneva as to their stance with regard to the protocol. So it's very discouraging that Canada is not supportive of this important international mechanism for enforcing human rights.
So that brings up the big political question, why? And of course, why do politicians do anything? And that's to get reelected, it seems to me. You know, I come from a background of watching a lot of politicians make speeches. So let's talk about how much of this denial of enforcement or denial of social rights is just, you know, another example of, you know, political spin. Let's grab that one.
You want me to?
Well, I have some ideas. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that we've seen, particularly with the Liberal, the current provincial Liberals, we've seen a number of announcements that they were running on the election platform. And I think this is a old political strategy about, you know, campaign promises. And once you're in office, the story kind of changes. And I think there were a number of particular policies. The clawback is one. Social assistance rates was another that I think we were coming out of a really harsh time under the Conservatives around both of those issues. And I think there were a lot of people that were hoping for some real change. And I think that change has been a lot longer to be realized than everybody had been hoping. So we'll see what happens in the next election. I think that's going to be a big question mark because there's been inaction on a lot of pretty important areas that we would hope to see some big changes in. And so if they're not able to live up to the commitments before, I would imagine that there will be some toll taken on voting day.
Okay, so we're going to go back to the same thing of the politicians will say one thing. And then they'll get elected and they'll do another. But then we're hoping that the UN will step in someplace and do more than just embarrass us. So there's got, you know, it sounds like we're circling the answer. But everybody has to be doing the same thing, right, from grassroots on up with the public.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've actually been fairly encouraged by is that there are certainly a number of people who are politicians now who are quite supportive of efforts to, and this is actually by, you know, more than like the NDP or the Liberals, it crosses parties, that there are people that are really interested in progressive change. I think we haven't reached the critical mass and that it'll take to make those kind of longer term changes. And I think that's really what we're hoping to do is that you know, we're not miles off here. I think we're reasonably close. I think the solutions are out there, and I think there are people in office that are genuinely interested in making progress on poverty issues. I think it's going to take more investment, and you know, in these days, it's difficult to come up with those dollars right now, particularly at the province.
I think if I could expand on that, I think. What Jeff's saying is important. We have a situation right now in Hamilton where we have quite a number of elected representatives who are on side with regard to a lot of the issues we're talking about around poverty issues. I get what you're saying with regard to spin, and spin is a huge issue. Politicians do say one thing, they do another thing. We've seen that particularly with regard to the National Child Benefit Supplement clawback, where the government clearly said that they were going to axe that clawback when they came into power. Our current provincial government, they haven't done that to this date. However, now that we, for instance, our report, the Income Security Working Group report to the UN, that got unanimous support at City Council. It's not a lot of things that get unanimous support at City Council, but it did get unanimous support. It's getting support from many of our elected politicians across the city. I think a lot of these issues didn't get talked about a lot. Unfortunately, they're just kind of the things that fly below the political radar recently, and I think that's got to change. I don't want to sound, I know I sounded a little bit Pollyanna earlier, very optimistic earlier, saying that that we just have to create a great situation and politicians will do the right thing. I think that's a possibility, and that's my hope. I think it needs. I'd like to make clear, though, that if they don't do the right thing, and I know you have a lot of very active listeners to this show, Maggie, I think people should be on the horn to their local elected representative and make sure they do the right thing.
Well, I have to say that Dalton McGuinty has refused to take any more emails, as I just discovered this last week. So, that makes it a little harder to get a hold of him and say, you know, the provincial government's not doing this and not doing that, especially when they don't want to communicate. And, of course, Harris, he just didn't even bother, you know. Don't even go there. There's no chairs in the waiting room for that office. So maybe it's the grassroots.
Well, one of the things I think the grassroots, the issue of the clawback, I think for me has been a real learning experience. I think, and one where Craig said, we've seen some real leadership at the local level by both politicians and staff there. And it's been really remarkable, I think. One of the things that we were able to do was raise their awareness about what was happening locally with regard to the clawback. And this is, you know, $100 per kid per month that is taken from families that are on social assistance. City gets a portion of that money. The province gets the bulk of it. I think they get 80%. But the city actually said, you know what, we think this is so wrong that we are going to create a way to get our portion of the money back to the people on social assistance. To my knowledge, this is one of the only cities that has come out and changed the way that they were delivering this money. And they used to fund programs. They're scaling that back. They're actually just getting cash to families who the money is taken from. And that is actually, it's a pretty courageous step, I think, to, and it's really putting your money where your mouth is. I mean, the council again and again has said, you know, we think it's wrong, but it's a provincial decision. What changed this time is that the local government said, you know what, it is wrong, and it's, the bulk of the money is and responsibility is the province, but we're going to do what we can here. And I think that was a really encouraging moment. And I think it actually sends a different message to the province than the one that they had been getting, which said, you know what, we think this is so wrong that we're going to change it locally, even if you're not going to change it provincially. And that adds another voice, I think, to the province saying, you know, this is something you have to look at.
What would you like to see done?
Well, I think one of the things that is always helpful is to have a sense of hope, particularly for people who are poor and living this story every day. That message is important. The change is possible. And I think to your listeners, it's important to remember that this is not something that has to exist in Canada. It's not something that's always existed in Canada. It's something that is very solvable. And one of the examples I think that is helpful is about 15 years ago, the government started noticing that there were seniors were becoming more and more poor, and it was a huge problem. And they were able, actually, and this is a lot due to seniors standing up and saying, we need help here and we need better policies put in place. The federal government and the provincial government, I think, came together to develop the guaranteed income supplement. There were a couple of particular programs and to advertise those benefits widely to make sure that people were taking them up. And what you saw was a real increase in the standard of living for seniors. Those kinds of things can happen when there's enough energy. And I think it's really important to remember that change is possible and that the solutions are out there.
Yeah, I think Jeff's absolutely right that change is possible. One of the things we've tried to focus on at the Income Security Working Group and the Human Rights Committee at that group with regard to our report is social assistance, because it's you know, perhaps kind of a bellwether issue for the right to an adequate standard of living. I think that immediately we could raise the shelter allowance portion of social assistance to rent to actual vacant market rents, to some relation to actual vacant market rents in the community. It's not rocket science to do this. We already know these numbers. The CMHC produces these numbers on a quarterly basis. The Housing Help Center in Hamilton produces these numbers on an annual basis. We know how much it costs to rent an apartment in the city of Hamilton. That we choose not to pay them that amount in a shelter allowance is just that. It's a choice. It's a policy decision. We need to change that policy decision and actually pay the shelter allowance. Then spend some time working with regard to the basic needs allowance and figuring out what the actual cost of the rest of those basic needs are. There needs to be an intelligent social assistance system that is based on an analysis of the cost of basic needs. We can figure out the shelter portion tomorrow. We can spend some time working on the basic needs system, but this is the kind of work that could start tomorrow, and it's just a matter of political will.
I want to thank you both for stopping by and giving us all this information. Every minute of it was just gold.
Thank you, man.
Good job. Thanks, Jeff Wingard from the SPRC, the Social Research and Planning Council of Hamilton, and Craig Foy. He is a staff lawyer with McQuesten Legal and Community Services. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Maggie.
I could get the entire speech that Doreen Silversmith gave to the UN. She was representing the Six Nations and some other poverty groups for women in Ontario. But Al Sue, the news director at CKRZ, the reservation radio station, was kind enough to let us have part of his interview he did with her when she returned. Here are some excerpts from that interview, Doreen Silversmith talking about the UN.
So I'm Doreen Silversmith, and with me is Emily Parody, the facilitator of our group Forward, and she accompanied me on a trip to Geneva. I think that we reached our objective, what we went there for, and that was to shame Canada. Hopefully they'll look at those recommendations and follow through with them on the human rights violations that they're, you know, we hope that they look at those recommendations and follow through and make things better for people all across this land.
That they don't really have much power to take any action, so we can just hope for some concluding observations that really reflect the concerns that we brought to them and that are really strongly worded. And then it's up to us to take it from there to bring those home and make sure that everybody knows about them, make sure that the United Nations has condemned homelessness and poverty and encroachment on Aboriginal lands in Canada. Doreen delivered a really powerful statement that I think gave them a sense of what was going on. And they responded very strongly.
CBC News World interviewed me live to air, and she couldn't, cut me off, so I got to say what I wanted to say, like about the corporate caterpillars creeping in our backyard and encroaching on our territory and violating our human rights. I spoke very strongly on these issues of homelessness, poverty, and social exclusion, and also, of course, about the Six Nations issue here that's happening now. So we hope to be successful in our fight too there with, on these issues. And I believe we reached our objective because the Canadian government was very embarrassed and red in the face when the UN committee was berating them, in particular the committee member from India who said...
Her name was Ms. Ghosh, and she talked about Canada's report and how... Canada themselves in their own report had talked about the very high rates of poverty in Aboriginal communities. And she said, and I see the government intends to address this with job creation. What is this, the trickle-down theory? Are people going to wait 200 more years for economic equality? She was really outraged and quoting their own report to them and just telling them how ridiculous it was. So that was one of the strongest moments of the whole thing, I think.
Yes, and also she brought the issue about people calling us Indians. And
she was saying, as a person from India, I find it especially ridiculous that you call these people who are not Indians, Indians, just because Columbus was lost.
Yeah. So under Article 1, the right to self-determination, that's what we were arguing for First Nations people and also for marginalized women. It's an international covenant.
Guarantees economic and social rights. And a lot of people don't realize that economic and social rights are as much a part of the basic framework of international human rights as civil and political rights are. So along with the right to vote and the right not to be imprisoned arbitrarily and the right to be free from torture and all that stuff that we think of as human rights, there's also a treaty that Canada has signed that guarantees that everyone has the right to adequate housing, the right to an adequate standard of living, the right to adequate food and to self-determination and to health. And these are rights that you don't see being carried out by our government.
And of course, most recently, Canada was folded to go in that new human rights tribunal at the UN. That's this is new, right? So, and they're violators. Like, who votes these people in? You know, a violating country of human rights. You know, so people need to be made aware of what Canada is really like. You know, and so, and I believe we did that.
What kind of responsibility goes along with any findings that they come up with in these tribunals, though?
Unfortunately, not a lot. They don't have any enforcement power. That committee has no enforcement power. So it's not like the civil and political rights where a country that's found to be in violation can actually be subject to sanctions or something at the UN level. So it's really up to us here in Canada to make sure that these things have an effect and to make sure that everybody knows about them and that people it raises people's awareness that there are human rights violations in Canada.
At one point, I actually stood up and said to the committee members, can't you grab Canada by the head and shove their faces in it and say, look, this is what's happening. This is who we are, and we're here, you know? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, we would like to do it, but we have to do it politely. And that's just it, isn't it? We've been polite too long, much too long.
Because this is similar to other actions that were brought to the attention of the United Nations, and they, in return, just simply gave Canada a warning.
No, so. I don't believe that it was for naught. I really believe that they heard us and that we got a lot of work ahead of us still. We plan to be in the government's faces all through and lobby them hard. I believe that we're going to affect change.